Hello, everybody, and welcome back to not only another day, but another week here at the Damage Report. And it being a Monday, you know that it's going to be fantastic with Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
I've had better Mondays.
What's going on with your Monday?
I mean, you know, when you decide to go out dancing late at night because it's Halloween and you're supposed to, but then you realize you're 19, and then you realize, no, you're not, you're old and you're tired and you shouldn't do this, and you got to get up and talk about the news.
Yeah, that can be rough.
But it was fun.
I'm glad it was your Halloween weekend and you did dress up, right?
Yeah.
What'd you go as?
Just the sexiest thing in the world, obviously. Squid Game Player 067 covered with blood and dirt.
Nice. That's the old man, right? Because when I think sexiest thing in the world.
Oh, anyway, yeah, for sure.
No, that's cool.
Hottie. Totally.
Yeah. It's like, you know, if you like dad bod, wait until great, great, great granddad bod. Yeah. Anyway, no, but I'm very glad that you dressed up and that you dressed up as a Squid Game character, because we're actually going to be talking about Squid Game. Our top 10 list this week, you had asked to talk about it, and I'm desperate to talk about it. So we're going to do our top 10 favorite things about Squid Game, and then I might mention one or two things. Not so much. But anyway, that's available to our tier 2 and tier 3 members on YouTube. It'll be coming up a little bit later on today. So very excited for that.
Yeah. Before we jump in everything, I do have to mention that the Bituation Room was put on hold and will be tomorrow night, 5-8 Eastern. That's the Bituation Room podcast. Not to be confused with the Twituation Room TYT stream that I do on Wednesdays at 1 p.m., 4 p.m. Eastern.
How could one confuse the two?
Clearly.
But anyway, that's very exciting and new. So everyone definitely tune in for that. Okay, well, with that, we do have 90 minutes of news coming at you. And I think it's a pretty spicy Monday, actually. We got Lindsey Graham saying something on January 6th that I have a feeling he's probably going to regret. AOC pressuring Biden. We got cancel culture against Florida University professors. Elon Musk wants you to believe that he cares. We got the most awful Karens. We're going to talk about cannibalism actually today. Isn't that fun? We have a really weird rundown. And along the way, if you wouldn't mind hitting the like button, sharing the stream, that'd be great. Before we get into our actual news, though, I did want to let you know about one thing. One of our interns, Josh, brought this to my attention. And I was just amazed by this. It's sad. An individual died, Ado Campiole, who was 93 years old, called the father of tiramisu. I assume most of you are probably familiar with tiramisu. It's an Italian dessert. I guess I just assume that most people like me believe that tiramisu is, I don't know, 500 years old or something, some amazing number of years. No, it's like in the 70s. It's like after Alien or whatever. But this individual, Ado Campiole, as well as a Mr. Linguinato, came up with it. And it's become this huge thing. I actually, unrelated, had tiramisu on Friday. And so anyway, I like learning little things, and I had never known that it was that modern, and that, you know, regrettably now the individual who helped make it has passed on. And yeah. I know that you're Italian, so I figured this would be a sad day for you as well.
Indeed. No, that's very sad. You know, tiramisu actually was named after his daughter, whose face looked like pudding. So that's why. Tiramisu, named after you. Que bella, tiramisu.
I thought this was going to be a very sad day. Apparently, we're going to go in a different direction. She also had lady fingers. So anyway. Yeah.
First of all, if you're it's not sad. Imagine how many nonas and nonos create new dishes in like anonymity for years and years. Everyone's like, oh my God, my grandma's thing. And it's like, no. But few have created tiramisu. Like, I think you or I, we might die and not leave a legacy as delicious and wonderful and special as tiramisu. So
I imagine we won't. I will say, and I'm gonna say I invented it. It probably existed before, but I don't want to look it up and ruin it. I came up with the inside out s'more, which I believe is just objectively better than a regular s'more. So hopefully someday I will be remembered as the father of the inside out s'more. Mm-hmm. And I will be remembered as Ado Campiole was. I'm not gonna live to 93, let's be clear, because I eat things like tiramisu and inside out s'mores.
Inside out s'mores, right. Anyway, but at a you know, cut down at the age of 56. But he made his mark. He made his mark.
Okay, everybody. Well, with that, we're going to launch into some news. I want you to all buckle up, hold on to your butts. It's about to get weird in here. I'll describe this more at some point, maybe during the first break. Anyway, let's jump into this. You might think you know everything about what happened on January 6th, you know, aside from things like the destruction of, was it Cori Bush's panic button and whether the night before representatives brought people in for tours. That we don't know about and we'll probably never get to. But the Washington Post has actually revealed some new stuff. They've been doing an incredibly in-depth analysis of the timeline of the 6th. And in it, they've revealed some things that I had not seen. And we've been covering this story from the very beginning. And Lindsey Graham comes out of these revelations not necessarily looking all that great from the point of view of the MAGA movement. So you can find all this, by the way, it's the second chapter of their reconstruction of January 6th. This chapter is titled Bloodshed, if you want to take a look at that. There's a lot more than we're gonna be covering here. But they say that the Senate and House leaders had been evacuated by Capitol Police and taken to an undisclosed location, but many lawmakers remained in their chambers for a few minutes before they were led to safety in the Hart Senate office building. Senator Lindsey Graham was irate that senators were forced to flee their own chamber. He yelled at the Senate Sergeant at Arms, quote, "What are you doing? Take back the Senate. You've got guns, use them. We give you guns for a reason, use them." So look, I think there were probably a lot of people on that day and since then that have been said it is weird that suddenly the police were really shy about using their guns. I think in the end it's good. I wish that they had been even slightly more so. But to have Lindsey Graham at the time saying these MAGA protesters should have been being gunned down, that is very much not how he has talked about that day since then. And so we can look at when he was terrified in the moment, when he feared, as many did, that he might die. He was all for the Capitol Police begin gunning down these people that were storming the Capitol. And Francesca, that is not something that I had seen before, at least.
No, and I think it actually is pretty significant. Lindsey Graham has like just real big broken clock energy. He definitely, you know, sort of snaps out of his own morality and comes back around to just being a crazy bootlicker. But in this case, he was right. There was a reason, and there is a reason the Capitol Police are armed, and it's arguably to defend the Capitol. That is the point. And as we've gotten more revelations, as more investigations and more inquiries have been done on January 6th, some of the stuff we already knew is being affirmed. And one of those things is that the FBI did not take the January 6th Stop the Steal rally seriously, which is insane to imagine. So right, we have a whole summer of uprisings, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, largely peaceful. Once again, we've got to reiterate. And of course, as soon as they descend on any Capitol building anywhere, it is like armed to the teeth, all kinds of National Guard, people being pepper sprayed so Trump can hold a Bible and claim that he read it, right? That's what we've seen. In the same summer, you saw anti-mask protesters and anti-lockdown protesters literally with AR-15s or whatever automatic gun they had storming Capitol buildings throughout this entire time, mowing down BLM protesters. And somehow the FBI didn't take it seriously or didn't think it was enough of a threat. How many more incidents at Trump rallies of violence do you need to prove that's what they do, that he and all the Republicans at this point are perfectly fine with kicking up and stirring violence and encouraging people to violence. So what I'll say about Lindsey Graham though, about asking this is it's true. Like there should have been more use of force, not necessarily gunning people down. I might dispute your characterization of that. I think it's just simply using arms and standing your ground to where you are, which is the Capitol building of the United States of America. And you know, there was a poignant point in the HBO documentary, 4 Hours at the Capitol, where Congressman Ruben Gallego basically says, we didn't want to leave the Capitol building because what happens in every kind of coup situation that's ever been around the world, whether US backed or not, it's always the point at which the president or Congress people leave the Capitol that they cede their control of their government. And that's exactly what some were being encouraged to do. There were like buses allowing Congress people to leave. And Ruben Gallego was like, no, we need to stay. And so in that sense, I think Lindsey Graham might be right.
Yeah, I think it, look, it is impossible, I think, for most people and definitely for me to divorce my knowledge of what ended up happening from it. Like, if I had perfect knowledge, and I mean, at this point, we don't have perfect knowledge, but we know ultimately when it ended up happening. I'm glad that they didn't shoot a lot more of those people. Because it doesn't seem like it was in the end necessary to save other lives. Now, you can then weigh that against the huge number of injuries, including grievous injuries against the Capitol Police. It is possible that they could have avoided a lot of that, but it would have been at the cost of horrible injuries to the protesters, perhaps death. Those are debates that we can have or whatever. It was very different at the time though, because we had no idea where this would end. I mean, some of those people clearly had murderous intent. They weren't able to track down Mike Pence. They didn't get Nancy Pelosi, but they wanted to. So yeah, you have to weigh both of those things, I think. In any event, for Lindsey Graham, we'll see if this actually, like, you know, penetrates the consciousness of the MAGA movement. Trump's spokesperson, Taylor Budowich, imagine still being a spokesperson, says that the whole report is fake news. I guess all of it is fake news. I don't know. So maybe they won't even believe that this is true of Lindsey Graham, but this is a movement that has been, that has picked up Ashley Babbitt in the wake of January 6th as the perfect martyr for the MAGA movement. And look, at the same time, they say that it was horrible that she died, and I think it was. I don't know how genuine they're being. I think that for some in the movement, if the Capitol Police had been more free with their guns, if not one protester had died, but 10 or 20 or more, I very much think there are some in the movement that would have seen that as the perfect martyr movement, that moment that they were looking for. And thankfully, in this case, we'll never know.
No, but I do want to say though, just like police everywhere, there are tactics for de-escalating a situation. And I'm not saying like you're set up to do that necessarily on that day, but think about it. I've been in protests. People out there who watch this show have been in protests. What happens? You get tear gas, you get, you know, pepper sprayed, you get surrounded by, you know, netting and say you're under arrest. There's immense amount of non-lethal, supposedly, ammunitions. You got rubber bullets, all kinds of ways to treat a so-called riot like a riot. Usually it's grandmothers protesting against wars, but you know, tomato, tomato. So don't give me this, like they don't know how to de-escalate a situation that's gotten out of control. And look, I think it is a tragedy that Ashley Babbitt died, but also I am floored that that was the only time that a bullet left a gun at that point. That being said, you can also fire into the air. You can fire around. True. You don't have to fire and aim directly at people. It might have had the same effect of people pull back.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And we did have some de-escalation tactics. We had diversionary tactics and that sort of thing. But a lot of what you're describing there wasn't tried, even outdoors early on. It's possible that it never would have come to them being in the Capitol if something like that had been done.
Yeah.
We'll never know. If they'd been just peacefully playing guitars or something like that, they probably would have gotten buzzed by a Black Hawk helicopter or something. But in this case, it was just retreat and maybe take a selfie. Okay. Coming out of the Washington Post breakdown of January 6th, we also have a little bit more information about Donald Trump from sources that were watching him during the time. One senior Republican close to him said Trump was enamored with how, quote, all these people are coming to fight for me. And they say, I don't think he appreciated what was going on. Well, depends on how you define it. I think he appreciated what was going on. Did he understand what was going on? Who knows? Who knows? But maybe, because remember, like those protesters were going in, they believed that Mike Pence had betrayed their movement. They didn't come to that because individually they'd all been like studying the Constitution like Gandalf going over old scrolls. They'd been told in speeches that Mike Pence can stop it and he chose not to. And while they were in there, I will remind you that on January 6th at 2:24 PM, Donald Trump tweeted, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a, quote, corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify, USA demands the truth. So they're in there searching the hallways for Mike Pence, and he tweets out, Mike Pence didn't have the courage. He didn't protect our country. We demand the truth. So what do? We'll probably pack up and go home, right? Well, weirdly, they didn't get that message. And anyway, on the Mike Pence thing, in these Washington Post revelations, we also learn a little bit more about John Eastman, who's been in the news once again recently. He's the guy behind that like postcard with the 7-step plan that's actually like 20 steps to get Trump back into office.
Classic. Classic TDR video. Everyone should go back and watch.
Fun. Somebody needs to find that. If you could send me that link, because we've put out a lot. Anyway, so in a radio interview in early January, he said that then Vice President Mike Pence had the power to throw the 2020 presidential election to the House of Representatives, saying it depended on whether Pence had, quote, courage and the spine. So he can do it. Will he? Well, we'll see. Is he courageous? Which is interesting, because when John Eastman has been asked about this more recently, he said that he told Mike Pence it was a, quote, open question, and that it would be a foolish option to pursue. That is not like saying you can do it if you have the courage and saying it's foolish. Those are two very different things. Now, John Eastman seems to want to be backing off of the pressure campaign against Mike Pence. We'll see. We'll see if anything ends up coming from that. But he's apparently very worried about you finding out about what he actually said.
Yeah, and let's be honest about the plan for January 6th. It was not to make a constitutional argument. Look at Eastman. Nobody cares. All you need to do is throw a minor bone to the base. So there's like a whiff of an argument, a constitutional argument. But that's just for the more cerebral MAGA. That's just for the ones who are like, one time I read the Constitution by accident. You know, like that's like, you just need that sort of as a veneer. The entire idea was to rely on the brute force and on the hordes of people who were pressuring folks. Maybe the idea was to get Congress people to leave. You know, whether they be Lindsey Graham, Mike Pence, or Nancy Pelosi and Democrats. Like,
yeah.
Let's stop being so naive, right? The pieces are all there. You know, this is the easiest puzzle to put together. Mm-hmm. It's not sky, it's not a bunch of clouds, it's just a circle and it's all coming together.
Yeah, it's not like complicated flowers or anything like that. Yeah, you're totally right. And by the way, let's bear in mind, there was never anything legitimate to the argument that Mike Pence could throw it to the states or whatever. That's just not within his purview. But pointing that out is not saying that they couldn't have done it or that it couldn't have worked. It couldn't have worked legitimately under our system of government, but this was a challenge to the legitimacy of our system of government. That's what it was. And simply like things being impossible politically, well, we are in crazy times. There were maniacs pooping in the Capitol building. These are times where weird things happen. So we avoided that. And in hindsight, it looks sort of laughable that they thought that would work, but that doesn't mean it couldn't have worked. What are you assuming that like, Senate Democrats would have never stood for that, or the Supreme Court would have stepped in? Have you been paying attention to our politics? Do you know who our leaders are? We might have very narrowly missed something. Now, interesting revelations about Donald Trump in a conversation that he had on January 6th with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. This is some pretty damning stuff coming out in this Washington Post piece. He says that called Donald Trump. Kevin McCarthy says, you have to denounce this. Trump falsely claimed to McCarthy that the rioters were members of Antifa, but McCarthy corrected him and said they were in fact Trump supporters. Trump then said, you know what I see, Kevin? I see people who are more upset about the election than you are. They like Trump more than you do. Well, we've got more and it's bad, but let's be very clear about what just happened there. It's Antifa. No, it's not. Oh, well then I guess they love me. Well then, but then you can't later say that it was Antifa again. You seem to have accepted that they're actually supporters of yours. McCarthy goes on to say, you've got to hold them. You need to get on TV right now. You need to get on Twitter. You need to call these people off. Trump responded, Kevin, they're not my people. You just said they love you. Anyway, McCarthy told the president, yes, they are. They just came through my windows and my staff is running for cover. Yeah, they're your people. Call them off. Damn. And Trump waited hours to even do his "you're very special, you're very loved" video. After Kevin McCarthy's telling him, "My staff is running for cover, they're your people." And bear in mind, like with Lindsey Graham, how hard has Kevin McCarthy gone against Donald Trump over the last 9 months or so? They were terrified at that point. They realized they'd gone too far. And then the next day they realized they still wanted to be members of the Republican Party, and they became fine with the guy that nearly lost their lives.
Yeah, were they patriots or were they Antifa, so-called patriots, obviously? I think the simple answer is this: Trump loves Antifa. See? You thought it was hypocritical, but no. In fact, I think Donald Trump is behind Antifa. Antifa is a false flag for Donald Trump. That's what he is, the mastermind behind it all.
He loves them.
Exactly. It's the only way to explain this like insane cognitive dissonance around who actually was storming the Capitol. Were they brave patriots who love America, who were just trying to defend it against tyranny, or were they rabble rousing Antifa creating a false flag situation to blame all of the law abiding citizens who just happened to step over into private property? I mean, and that's the other thing about the FBI downplaying the threat of January 6th is like, yeah, you downplayed it because they were white people who took private jets in after they like closed down their businesses and, you know, took a few days off because they could to just, you know, like just some light sedition. Yeah. Like that's why you didn't take them seriously, is because they weren't young black people demanding that they not be, you know, shot down in the streets. Just that small distinction. And the other thing I'm gonna say, and it's interesting, but look, Senator Lindsey Graham and Kevin McCarthy are senators, right? We know that a lot of the people who were in on this, specifically from the inside, were Congress people. And we also know the way that politics works and the way that a lot of, you know, poop floats up in this case. People like Kyrsten Sinema, who are in Congress, they're representatives, and then they get elected to the Senate. Imagine if Paul Gosar were in the Senate. Imagine if Mo Brooks was in the Senate. Imagine when these guys get to the Senate.
It's inevitable.
They're gonna have a plan. They're not gonna be like, oh, when people are running for cover, they'll be like, no, 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 I've got my helmet, I've got my flak jacket, let's go.
Yeah.
That should be chilling for all of us. That's what happens if any of these people remain in office or if they are allowed to actually further their political career.
100%. Yeah, it's fairly inevitable. I mean, like, yeah, maybe we can again have faith that Marjorie Greene would never join the Senate or whatever. Okay, well, maybe. Hope not. We do have Kyrsten Sinema though. Anything's possible. Really fast, I want you to bear in mind that you know, with all these new revelations of all this awful stuff that happened, including in phone calls, seems noteworthy that Donald Trump is seeking to prevent January 6th investigators from accessing daily presidential diaries, drafts of election related speeches, logs of his phone calls, handwritten notes, and files of top aides. Like, if what is in the draft text of a presidential speech on January 6th that you're so worried about that you don't want it to come out? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out, maybe we won't. I do want to note one other last thing though. There's a lot of horrifying notes in this bloodshed chapter. You should definitely look into it. One that I noted, I hadn't seen before, had to do with Pramila Jayapal. It says they were detailing the personal experiences of a number of different representatives and senators. So like with Lindsey Graham, like with Kevin McCarthy, fight or flight instincts began to kick in for Pramila Jayapal as she moved her walking stick to her right hand, her dominant one, so she could hit anyone who came near her. Quote, "I was starting to plan that I might die, and if I was going to, then I was going to go down fighting," she said. That is horrifying. Reminder of how bad this was. This woman, Pramila Jayapal, we've had on the show, was planning on trying to cane people as they murdered her. Jeez. And it was a serious thing. Mo Brooks, who you mentioned, has continued to finesse the fact that he wore a bulletproof vest to the speech that he went to on January 6th. He eventually tweeted out just a couple days ago, "I wore the vest because of leftist threats and staff and wife want me to." Yeah, throw your staff and your wife under the bus, buddy. It's leftist threats. There were no leftists rampaging through the Capitol there. But I do want to remind you of one last thing. So Pramila Jayapal there was very worried about her potentially dying. We have had instances of this before. Nancy Mace, Republican congresswoman, had talked about how scared she was before she then turned around and mocked people like AOC who were scared. You might recall AOC talking about her experience of how terrified she was. How much time was spent by the right wing mocking her? How dare you pretend that you were scared? It's either performative or best case scenario. She's a woman who's being overly dramatic. How could she do that? Well, I want to remind you, Lindsey Graham was yelling at people, start shooting them. Kevin McCarthy was calling up Trump, my staff is running for cover. You've got to get these people out of here.
Yep.
Why aren't they pathetic? Why aren't they being performative? Why is it just people like AOC whose fear is unjustified? You got all these Republican men who were terrified that they were about to be murdered. They were calling on the sergeant at arms to start gunning people down potentially to save their lives. But AOC was being pathetic. She was being performative. Why was she scared? It's perfectly fine for these men though.
Yes, and Kevin McCarthy, who is not in the Senate yet. But yes, he is in the House of Representatives. Yeah. And I apologize for that mistake. But yeah, I mean, everyone was running for their lives. Sorry. Like Mike Pence was in some sort of, you know, in the Pence cage or wherever they keep him, you know, when he has like immoral thoughts. You know, he's got a whole bunker that he goes to on the regs. And so he was there and they were scared. But that's the thing. It's like, what do you expect people to do? I mean, that's the other thing. You're like, if this was a coup, you didn't tell all your, you know, all your Republicans what they needed to do. You know what I mean? And that was sort of part of it. It was like, well, now you have to choose. What are you gonna, what side are you on? Sort of, you gonna go with the political violence? Let's do this.
Yeah.
Or are you gonna get scared and run for your life? Cause oh my God, my windows are being broken in. So it's, yeah. I mean, I am curious as to see that draft statement that Trump had ready, other than the, hey, it's time to go home. Maybe there was a victory is ours speech.
Yeah, mission accomplished. Okay, we are gonna take our first break. When we come back, we're gonna be talking about some totally different stuff. Actually, AOC will pop up. We're gonna be talking about student loans though and voting rights after this. Anyway, by the way, a few things to let you know about what's happening on the network soon. Tomorrow, Senator Nina Turner will be joining us for the damage report. So that's very exciting. Love talking politics to Nina Turner. She's been a regular fixture on the Tuesday show. So look forward to that. Also, right after our show, you can look forward to Indisputable, which will be coming up in about 1 hour at youtube.com/indisputabletyt, as well as Twitch and all of that. Tonight's also old school, so lots to look forward to. And first of all, what you can look forward to though is more news. AOC isn't just trying to pressure Biden, as well as others involved in the reconciliation infrastructure bill negotiations, to make that a better bill. She's also trying to remind everyone, hey, Biden's also the president and can, in theory, do things other than talk to Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. She was asked on her Instagram account, do you think student loan payments will return in a few months? That's obviously something people are very worried about. The basically, the halt that we have right now is only going to last a little bit longer. And she says that given how much Build Back Better, the reconciliation bill has been slashed, it's more important than ever that we bring the heat on Biden to cancel student loans. He doesn't need Manchin's permission for that, which I love that as a little dig against Biden, thinking that he needs Manchin's permission for things. And now that his agenda is thinly sliced, he needs to step up his executive action game and show his commitment to deliver for people. And I am very glad that she is talking about that. You do have to balance a lot of different concerns. And I think this is one of the best things that we can focus on to pressure Biden, not just because of the huge amount of potential there is to help people out, but also Biden desperately needs to reassure people who voted for him, who organized for him, who volunteered for him and donated money to his campaign that got him into office, that he's actually gonna do something. And this is entirely within his own power. He can't hide behind Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema or Mitch McConnell or any of them. He could do it right now if he wants to. We could come back from the next break to the breaking news that he did it, and he is not doing that. And so while we can criticize him on a lot of things, I think he is especially deserving of criticism for the things he chooses not to do that he could do anytime he wants to. Francesca, what do you think?
Yeah, it's completely in his control to eliminate student debt and would solidify his reelection from here until I don't know who's who, when. If he wants to keep on running, keep on going. Just like, seriously, it is the best way to ensure that a young group of voters who've been disillusioned and disenchanted by your entire presidency thus far, maybe people wanted Bernie Sanders to be president, will vote for you again. Like, that is not an exaggeration to say that politically, it is a very smart move, not only just policy and morally, that there's no reason why college should cost as much and people are being strapped with debt. It'd be a huge boost to the economy. But not only, it just like would be ensure you that you will be reelected. Stop with the hand wringing, just do it.
Yeah. Yeah, or certainly help. And not just because, you know, I think people rightly will want, they will be happy that this happened rather than looking forward to the rest of their life, effectively 30 or 40 years spent paying for these things. But also, it will send an indisputable signal to the electorate that he's actually gonna do things. And look, honestly, in a way, it would almost be like, it would almost make it good that there are those in his party that are trying to block things, because it provides an opportunity for him to say, I'm not going to allow any of these obstacles to stop me.
Yeah.
Like, if it was up to me, we wouldn't have a filibuster. Unfortunately, it's not directly up to me. Now, that setting aside the fact that, of course, he could pressure the senators who are stopping it from being changed. But he could say, okay, legislation's really hard to do because the Republicans won't allow anything. I'm gonna make sure that you know that. I'm gonna make sure that the American people know that they've been stopping things. And even where they're not, you have people like Manchin and Sinema. I'm gonna make sure that you know what they're doing, but I'm also going to deliver in whatever way is required with the power that I have. That's what the Republicans do when they want to get something done. There's not much that they actually wanna get done, and not any of it affects the working poor. But he could do that. He has this opportunity, and instead he is just meeting with Manchin, having phone calls with Sinema, and allowing more and more days to pass in the only possible productive time of his presidency. If they lose their you know, hold on the Senate and the House, then there will literally be nothing done, up to and including Supreme Court judges, by the way. They will not get one if they lose control. If they lost control in a week, they wouldn't. And they are almost guaranteeing that that is what is going to happen if they don't deliver. He needs to send a signal. And he's choosing not to. And honestly, if he did it, and if Manchin and Sinema freaked out, if the Republicans freaked out about it, good. Have them spending their time on Fox News telling tons of conservatives with student loan debt that they should be burdened by that debt. Have that be what the Republicans have to campaign on going into the midterms. So there's just so much upside. And the fact that he's not doing it is damning against him.
Yes. I mean, obviously, like, let's give them credit. They would never talk about that. You know, they wouldn't even mention it if it happened. They'd be like, yeah, this happened anyway.
Free stuff. They love to talk about how he's giving free stuff to people.
No, absolutely. And yeah, they would bring on some, they would bring on me, who got like a degree in, you know, women's studies and globalization, and be like, look at her, what is she doing? She's got a YouTube channel, what do you haven't put it to use? Like that kind of thing, which would be honestly a great sell against college in and of itself, because they are against college and universities and higher education, because that leads to an understanding of democracy and plurality and history. There's always that, and that's bad. But yeah, I mean, look, this is also, I think, after the Build Back Better Act, which again has not passed, we don't know if it will pass, but it's still not a legacy in terms of what Biden aimed to do in office. And it's a question, right? Like, did he want to just be the guy who wasn't Trump? Because yeah, that's sort of what made him run in the first place. He thinks he's the only one who can win. And look, he won. And is that end of story? Are we sort of wrapping it up? But then he had this whole other piece, which was, yes, I'm going to take on the mantle of sort of the Bernie Sanders transformative government. Like, I want to be, you know, an FDR style president. I want to be someone who's going to actually help the working class. I want to potentially get back to like Democrats' roots. And that was sort of that second piece. And maybe that was bolstered by, you know, trying to appeal to Bernie Sanders' base. But so far, we haven't seen that. And we haven't, yeah, we just haven't seen leadership. Like, yes, the vaccine rollout. And I don't want to ignore or downplay how important it is to vaccinate people, to get people healthy, to help people live normal lives. That's huge. Do they celebrate that they've done that enough? In my opinion, not nearly. But let's move on to something that like we can all agree on, since vaccines are controversial, right? It seems like he doesn't actually have a legacy other than I got us out of the Trump years and I got us out of COVID, which again, not the worst things, but what are you gonna do to propel people to actually vote for you again, to have a vision for your party that honestly has none?
Yeah, exactly. And he either sees that and isn't acting on it, or he doesn't see it, and neither of those are good. Okay, super quick, we're gonna jump into one more story in this block. Let's do it. Under Ron DeSantis, Florida is one of many states that in the wake of Republican losses in the last election have decided that you voting is an inconvenience and they'd very much like less of it. And so they passed a bill, it's been signed, that is gonna make it harder in a number of different ways for people to vote. Now there is pushback against that law. And when something like this happens, you want experts to testify. Experts in democracy, in voting, in voter suppression, those sorts of things. Again, Florida would prefer less of that sort of testimony, because at least three University of Florida professors were denied permission from the school to testify in a major voting rights case against the state. The plaintiffs in the case, which was filed in May, are a coalition of voting rights organizations that are suing Florida's Secretary of State, Laurel Lee. So as part of the testimony, the plaintiffs were seeking three professors from the university to testify as expert witnesses. All three have specializations in voting rights and behavior and election law, so they seem like you don't necessarily have to agree with their conclusions, but they certainly would know something about what they're talking about. But university officials said that because the school was a state institution, participating in a lawsuit against the state is, quote, adverse to UF's interest and could not be permitted. In their filing, the lawyers sought to question Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, on whether he was involved in the decision. Here is where it gets a little bit dirty. So Mr. DeSantis has close allies at the University of Florida, including the head of the school's board, Morteza Hosseini, being a major Republican Party donor and a DeSantis advisor who co-chaired a transition team formed after the governor's victory in 2018. I can't imagine a dirtier situation than that. Drain the swamp, you know, hashtag and all that. That guy actually popped up in some more dirty news recently. So the Gainesville Sun reported that Mr. Hosseini, who is known as Maury, had arranged this fall for the University of Florida to hire and grant tenure to a controversial UCLA professor, Dr. Joseph Ladapo. If that name's familiar, that's because 2 weeks later, Mr. DeSantis named him the state's Surgeon General. So like, they just set up this kind of phony job so that he could have this tenured position when they elevate him immediately to this other thing. Like, what is the University of Florida right now? Is it like just for the personal pleasure of DeSantis to do whatever he wants? And of course, like, you're not gonna be shocked to find out that regardless of whether the state is a party to a lawsuit, professors testify constantly in those sorts of things. This is very much a specific block against a challenge to a law that he was very much a fan of. This is massive corruption, Francesca.
Yeah, I mean, it's Florida's very own, you know, little kleptocracy or big kleptocracy and the beginning of authoritarianism. I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, and it's like, what is at the heart? Yes, there's corruption. Yes, there's on the board of trustees, but what is at the heart of Republicans' problem with higher ed and universities is they can't fully manipulate all of the information that's coming in and out of them. Period. So they buy boards of trustees, you know, they give their friends kickbacks, they scheme up loans to get their and ways to get their daughters and sons onto rowing teams that don't actually exist. I mean, there's obviously many different ways to game the system, but at its heart, it's that I can't control what people are saying and people are learning. This is an institution that is wild, and it's wild because it's free. It's wild, not obviously it's expensive, but it is actually a place for free thought. For as much as Republicans, oh, the freedom of speech, freedom of thought. No. That actually happens every day at universities when kids bring in articles of Cosmo magazine and are like, so I was saying, I didn't do the reading, but in Cosmo, and you're just like, oh my God, freedom of speech. Like that, so yeah, DeSantis, it's really chilling. And I the right's never gonna cover it. They won't talk about this, obviously. No, and especially
censorship, cancel culture. Nope. Doesn't count. This is the BS that is cancel culture. That this stuff doesn't actually get filed under that.
100%.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see. There is a challenge to it. Perhaps they'll be freed up. We'll see. Anyway, we do have to take a break though. When we come back, Elon Musk wants to assure you that he does care about solving poverty. He just doesn't want to spend a cent to do it after this. Okay, with that, let's jump right into this. Last week, we found out that Elon Musk on one day made billions upon billions of dollars. And to put it in perspective how much money that is for one day of earnings, we told you about the fact that the World Food Program director had pointed out how easy it would have been to cure effectively all of the world's hunger with just a small portion of what he made. Works out to this, David Beasley, director of the World Food Program, says we need billionaires to step up. He noted that even just 2% of Elon Musk's current net worth could solve world hunger. Translates to about $6 billion. That is a lot of money to you or I. That was it 4 hours of what he made on that one Monday? He says that the top 400 billionaires in the US, they had a net worth increase of $1.8 trillion in the past year. 0.36% of that would do it. It's like one of those things where you like round up to donate to charity. If the billionaires would just round up, they could cure world hunger. Well, Elon Musk is always on Twitter. Literally right now he's tweeting. So he responded to this saying, if WFP can describe on this Twitter thread exactly how $6 billion will solve world hunger, I will sell Tesla stock right now and do it. Which I'm sure if you're a massive Elon stan, sounds like him being willing to do it. To me, it sounds incredibly defensive. If you can in 180 characters describe how we cure all of this, then I'll do it. If not, you've lost $6 billion, which is kind of how you act when what you care about is your Twitter more than people going hungry. But I don't know, Francesca, maybe I'm just being too hard at him. I don't know.
No, absolutely. The worst billionaire who just made like a boobies joke the other day. Like, cool, dude, you're the richest man on earth. And you're being snot-nosed about it. Like, at least Bill Gates has the decency to pretend like he cares while actually evading billions in tax dollars, but then actually helping people, because the Gates Foundation does help people. Yeah, they're getting all the patent rights, but they help people. Elon Musk does not care about any of that. It is very much a punk response to the World Food Program. He's not going to do it. He doesn't matter what comes next. He's not going to do it, but let's talk about it.
No. He says it must be open source accounting so the public sees precisely how the money is spent. That's all it is. That's all he needs. Well, then the WFP responded. David Beasley says, I can assure you that we have the systems in place for transparency and open source accounting. Your team can review and work with us to be totally confident of such. And at that point, that's it. He didn't respond anymore. Maybe since we produced this, he's responded. But he had pretty much dropped off the map, because at the end of the day, this isn't about transparency. Look, and maybe Elon Musk is right. Maybe $6 billion won't do it. Maybe it's 8, maybe it's 12, maybe it's 40. Maybe no matter what it is a tiny little fraction of how much he actually has to do an immeasurable amount of good. At the end of the day, if he wanted to do it, he'd do it. Whether they can explain it in a tweet or not, if he can make a flamethrower or bore a hole through Las Vegas, he could do this if he wanted to. But this isn't his like little quirky trolley type thing. It's actually serious work that people who actually care about other humans do. It's not as fun. You don't get to do little jokes on Twitter about curing world hunger. So he's not actually interested. He's not going to do any of it.
No, it's also because it's not his idea. This is the pathology of billionaires who got all of their money from dad and, you know, the emerald mine, but then made his own money, except for like, you know, stole like other people's and took their talents and their expertise and then, you know, marketed it. But they're the genius, but then the workers, you know, then, you know, et cetera. So no, it is, he is mad because it's not his idea, but once he figures out how to put like, you know, one of his, light tunnels of transportation underneath like a crop of like a field of crops that can make food grow faster. Yeah. Like then he's all about it, but it's gotta be him. No. See, you can't, you know, look, sir, it's the same as I'd love to give you $5 because you want, you know, you want to buy a meal, but what are you gonna do with the money? That's I can't trust that you're not gonna buy drugs with that money.
Exactly. Yeah, it's that times a billion. That's all it is. And you know, of course, people are defending. And again, at the end of the day, I don't even care about the specifics. My point is, you are under no obligation to do any of this. Of course, it's your money. But with great power comes something I don't remember. I think that there's a saying about that. And he is choosing to do certain things and not others. And if you have the impossibly easy option of doing this, because again, he could spend 10 times this and still be the richest man on the planet. If you don't do something this good, that would mean nothing to you. It wouldn't be a sacrifice in any way for you. Then I'm gonna judge you way harder than I would judge a regular person giving up a dollar. Because that dollar means more to their net worth than this does to you, and he doesn't care at all about it.
No.
Don't be one of the people that defends Elon Musk.
He cares about dunking on Twitter. And also, by the way, I just wanna say really, really quickly, it is not that expensive. That is if you stop like pouring external money into countries and giving them like food that's not sustainable. People, when they have the actual technology and knowledge to grow their own food, to preserve their communities, it is actually not that expensive at the end of the day.
Exactly. Can we go to F actually? I think we have time for F. I don't think that we have time for, can we? Thank you. You probably heard about natural immunity recently. It's another excuse for you to not have to get vaccinated. After your ivermectin and your hydroxychloroquine, you're probably looking for another reason that you don't have to be a part of the solution. So people have been telling you online, if you've probably been infected, and that's better than getting vaccinated anyway, so don't even worry about it. That's actually not true. Not that that's gonna get through to any of these people, but I wanted you to know that the CDC says, according to a new study, that among blah, 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 basically people who had been sick before are gonna be hospitalized with COVID infections at a 5.5-fold higher rate than those who were vaccinated and had not been infected. And although it is rare, simply because you were infected does not mean that you will not be infected again. I don't expect that this is gonna get through to anyone, but I want to be clear, all of the data, perhaps not data that you see on 4chan, but you know, actual scientists and labs and stuff says that being vaccinated is better than natural immunity. I would hope that's enough to put this talking point to rest, but people gotta get views on their videos. So expect to see a lot more about natural immunity in the future.
Yeah, do you want something natural or do you want super boost immunity? Hell yeah, I want that super immunity. I don't want natural immunity. Also, let's be real. When you tell someone, oh, now that you had COVID, you got natural immunity. That's just something we tell you because you got COVID and we kind of feel sorry for your ass. You know, like
yes.
We just tell you that and then it make you feel better for like not being able to taste coffee anymore. But the reality is you should get a booster shot and I think it's important. Like I was just telling somebody the other day, like, oh, but you got natural immunity and they got boosters. And I was like, actually, that's super smart. So now we have the data to back it up to say that, yes, you want that super immunity. Same thing with flu shots, right? I mean, we've seen that just because you got the flu doesn't mean that you are suddenly immune from getting it again that season and for sure the next season.
Other variants and even other the variants. Natural immunity can certainly wear off. Though, as I said, I don't expect a lot of people to be convinced by this. There was a video of some news channel talking about this. And here's a screenshot of the replies. As far as I can tell, every single one of them is, no, how dare you, come on, natural immunity, it's better, I swear, whatever it takes for me to not have to be responsible. And I'll bear in mind, of course, to get that natural immunity, you have to get COVID. And when the stakes are whether you get COVID or not, it has always seemed weird to me that getting COVID was considered a perfectly acceptable way to not get COVID. But I don't know, maybe I'm crazy. Oh, by the way, in addition, I will remind you that rates for vaccination and unvaccination for instance, getting cases, the unvaccinated get it 6 times the rates. In terms of deaths, it's 12 times higher for those who aren't vaccinated. I don't know how much more evidence you need to just get the jab. Just get it, man. I just got my booster. It's super simple. You can do it too. Okay, we're gonna take a short break, but if you're on Twitch or YouTube, we got more news coming for you right up after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.